Welcome back to another episode of Terms and Conditions. I am Berhan Taye.
And I'm Nima Iyer. This is episode 6. We will be taking a break for a few months, and then we're coming back to you with great topics and ideas to satisfy your tech cravings.
Yep. So Nima, what are we talking about today?
We're talking about surveillance because we wanted to round off these few episodes on a high note. But really, why surveillance? And here's a short quote from George Orwell's 1984 that says, "Always eyes watching you and the voice enveloping you. Asleep or awake, indoors or out of doors, in the bed or bath, no escape. Nothing was your own except the few cubic centimeters in your skull." This was picked by Berhan, by the way. So maybe we should define surveillance before we move forward. So what exactly is surveillance? So I would say surveillance is a monitoring of activities of citizens. So it can be following your movements, your online presence, what you buy, why you buy it, who you're talking to, how long you've known them, what books you're reading, and it goes on and on and on, right? Because ultimately, when you think about surveillance, it can be used to divide and sort people, and it provides information on the attributes of a person, but it also helps to create a risk profile of their future tendencies or behaviors based on their past.
Yeah, no, that's really important. And, you know, in this conversation that we're having, we make surveillance seem like it just started a few decades ago. That's not really the case. There's really quite a strong tie between colonization and surveillance. You know, monitoring and controlling of large populations was a tactic and is an ongoing legacy of colonialism and the way that it existed. For instance, national ID systems were used to monitor people's movement. Passports are used to surveil the movement of citizens and individuals. So surveillance is a very wide topic, way bigger than 30-minute episode.
Yeah, when I was actually just reading about passports, and I think it's an interesting conversation because when passports were introduced after World War I, as you said, you know, in the 1920s, no one really liked the idea of being labeled and packaged and dehumanized within the pages of this booklet. But because it was becoming institutionalized, no one could get around without one. And it really struck me that we're 100 years away from 1920. It's 2020 now. And the debate seems to be the same. You know, we're kind of fighting these digital IDs that are aimed at packaging humans within these small cards or within these IDs and dehumanizing them based on where they're from. Because even today, it's so difficult to navigate the world based on the passport you have. And there's this concept of good passports that let you roam the world as you please. And then the bad passports that you can barely get around. You need visas and you're not even allowed in some countries. They're travel bans. So it's still a very pertinent debate that we had, just as you said, it's not something new. We had this conversation 100 years ago and we're still in the same place. So that said, in this episode, we won't be able to cover all forms and kinds of surveillance, but today we just really want to focus on government surveillance and the different frameworks that allow for law enforcement and intelligence surveillance to invade our privacy.
Yes, and PSA, we're not saying that all forms of surveillance are illegal or are not necessary. So we just want to put that caveat out there before we get some trolls telling us, some surveillance is so good.
Yeah, epi maybe, but yeah. Mm-hmm. We will be talking about mass and targeted surveillance conducted by competent or incompetent government entities. And in today's episode, to just give you a look at what we'll be talking about, we're talking about Ethiopia's government surveillance practices and the current, more covert or clandestine surveillance practices. We're talking about Uganda's CCTV cameras and new intelligent network monitoring system regulation, and South Africa's regulation of interception of communications and provision of communication-related information act law, and the challenges that it has had in court. So, Berhan, start us off.
Yes. Ethiopia is quite has been a beacon of hope for a lot of African countries when it comes to surveillance. So before the current administration came to power, you know, covert and overt surveillance operations were quite common in Ethiopia, and not just affecting Ethiopians that are living in the country, but also people in the diaspora. So DC, Stockholm, London are all areas, like cities that are, you know, Ethiopians are highly surveilled in by their governments. We're also not sure how this might have changed with the current government. It seems like, you know, some of the surveillance practices that we used to see before now have gone underground. But, you know, Ethiopian surveillance is not just, you know, is not just a practice that's done by the government on its own. There's also legal frameworks that would allow for that to happen. So, for instance, the anti-terrorism proclamation, which has been reformed now, was really instrumental in that. The computer crime legislation, telecom fraud. So they'll come up with so many legislation that would enable them to spy, restrict, monitor online activity of Ethiopians at home and abroad. So there are two really interesting agencies to look at when we're talking about surveillance in Ethiopia. So the first one is Information Network Security Agency, what we normally refer to as INSA. And the other one is the National Intelligence Security Services, which is the very similar ones that we have everywhere, called NIS or NIS. So these... These are actors and, you know, government institutions that that surveil, you know, and are really critical to the surveillance structure. So like many other countries, telecom companies really play a key role in surveillance. They have access to the numbers, the, you know, live locations of individuals. So they're really, really critical in this conversation. So, of course, you know, looking at private companies beyond telecom companies, there are many other companies that sell secretive like softwares to governments. So the NSO Group is a really terrible and famous one right now. The hacking team, you know, Cyberbit, Finfisher, and others were all you know, instrumental in, for lack of a better word, instrumental in the surveillance of citizens. So what's really interesting is that, you know, the National Security and Intelligence Apparatus have adamantly targeted opposition groups and activists, journalists, researchers with malware attacks for years. At one time, according to WikiLeaks documents, the government had paid the hacking team close to 1 million euros to surveil activists and you know, others in the diaspora. So can you just imagine, Ethiopia is such a poor country? We are. I will admit that paying $1 million to a company so that you can go through somebody's message is so crazy, but that's something that they've done. Many reports from Citizen Lab, and we love Citizen Lab, they show that activists in the diaspora have fallen prey to these attacks as recently as December 2017. In addition to targeted digital attacks, the Ethiopian social media activity is always surveilled. Previously and even now, today as we're recording this, you know, there's an internet shutdown in Ethiopia, and for government agencies and you know, critical infrastructure that have access to the internet today, social media is completely blocked. Not even paid VPNs will get you through. That's how bad it is. So the Ethiopian government has repeatedly, you know, prosecuted many for their social media activities. They've come up with hate speech and fake news legislation that would restrict certain conversations online, and that would, you know, by default, make the broadcasting authority, you know, mass surveil, you know, content online, for instance. So the physical trade and the psychological trauma of surveillance endured by many Ethiopian activists and journalists has not been sufficiently studied. And I think if there's a PhD student listening to this conversation, there's a topic there.
Yeah, and it's how many days since the shutdown now in Ethiopia? We've lost count.
Today's the 13th day. Yeah.
Wow. Okay, so if we move further south to Uganda, last year there were many headlines saying that the Ugandan police had spent $126 million on CCTV cameras from Huawei. And their justification for these cameras were that they really needed to cut down on spiraling violent crime across the city. And this was the solution. And activists in the country and opposition members, you know, they're right to be worried for a number of reasons. Because the questions that come to mind are, who will be viewing this footage, and what capacity or manpower do the staff who view this footage have to conduct this work? And also, who has access to this footage that's collected? Who owns this data? Does it stay in the country? Does it leave the country? I remember recently, either last year or a few months before that, there was a really gruesome accident which resulted in a number of fatalities. And within a few minutes of the accident happening, this footage from CCTV camera was posted onto Twitter. And for me, I was thinking, you know, this could be the last moments of someone's lives. And it's just all over Twitter. Who had access to that footage, and why did they think to put it on Twitter? And then the other question that I have is on unregulated facial recognition technology. We're seeing this globally. And the question is, what is this footage going to be used for in the realm of facial recognition when there's such few laws to regulate what happens to that data? And on the other hand, you know, this can be used as a tool for oppression of dissenting voices. Ingrid Turinawe, who is the leader of the Forum for Democratic Change, which is Uganda's largest opposition party, she was quoted as saying, "The CCTV project is just a tool to track us, hunt us, and persecute us." Now, these cameras in Uganda are part of Huawei's Safe City Initiative, which has been rolled out in more than 200 cities worldwide, of course, in China, but also in Pakistan, in Russia. And a recent article that came out in the Washington Post claimed that Huawei was helping African governments to spy on, crack down, and arrest opposition members and critics, just as Turinawe had mentioned. And then Huawei responded by releasing a memo stating, "Huawei's code of conduct prohibits any employees from undertaking any activities that would compromise the data or privacy of our customers or end users, or that would breach any laws." And I think even the framing of the word customers or end users, because then where do citizens fall in that gradient of customers or end users? And are the customers governments? Anyways, all right, let's move on to South Africa.
Yeah. So, you know, many of these countries that are, you know, conducting surveillance are not just doing surveillance without any form of policy and legal framework. So the South African one is super interesting. So the parts of the regulation of interception of communication, provisions of communications related information act. Ooh, that's a long one. What we normally refer to as the RICA law in South Africa is the law that would allow the government to legally surveil citizens and, you know, and foreigners in the country. And very recently, courts in South Africa said this specific legislation was unconstitutional. So the media group called Amabungane brought a case against the surveillance law challenging its constitutionality. And this came after a South African journalist by accident found out that he was being surveilled as he was investigating a corruption case against Jay-Z, the former president of South Africa, which he's also known as Jacob Zuma. So what makes this this court case very interesting is that, one, it's the first time that we've seen in an African court for a court to say, you know, this surveillance legislation is not constitutional. And they identified three very important things for us to focus on. The first one is that it didn't allow for anybody to be notified that they've been surveilled. So once this, the, you know, the active surveillance is over, you should notify citizens why they've been surveilled, but it doesn't have any procedure that would allow for that. So then for that specific reason, it was ruled to be unconstitutional. And this specific journalist found out that he was being surveilled by accident. There was no procedures to let him know that he has been, you know, on a specific list, his conversation had been intercepted. The second one is that, you know, even when governments are conducting, you know, lawful interception of information and lawful surveillance, in this specific legislation, there was no procedures that, you know, gave the state guidelines on how to share and process this information. So how do you share it from one government surveillance entity to another, for instance? This was a really important one because, again, this is very sensitive information that you're sharing about people without their knowledge, so there at least should be some procedures. The third one, and I think the one that I find super interesting, is the fact that the court said, you know, this legislation, again, is unconstitutional because it does not protect or doesn't have procedures to protect journalists or actively practicing lawyers. So these are really, really significant things. And for this reason, the court said this constitution, this legislation is unconstitutional and has sent it back to the legislative body to be redrafted. Of course, the government is appealing, so we're yet to see what comes out of it, but it's a significant one. The other one that we should look at is the Nigerian Communications Commission. And so a bunch of lawyers have brought a case against the Nigerian Communication Commission, particularly because in a similar context as South Africa, that they had surveilled the correspondences of journalists, that are particularly, you know, investigating sensitive matters of the state. So these two cases are really important. So the South African one, I think, sets a precedent, especially for a lot of Commonwealth countries, you know, and it also feels really nice as an African to see another African court say that, you know, surveillance is unconstitutional. So these two are important cases to look out for.
Nice. We can talk about either a lack of regulation or overregulation or some regulation and how these laws are drafted and in whose favor they're drafted. But what I wanted to talk about now is how oftentimes we see newspaper headlines that are rife with postings on how China is exporting their digital authoritarianism and surveillance methods to Africa. And yeah, there's a lot of focus on China, China, China. And my question was, is it just China? You know, why is China being vilified in all of this? And so I just wanted to highlight some other cases that have come out in recent times. So in 2015, Zimbabwe accepted a gift of cyber surveillance software from the Iranian government, including IMSI catchers, which are used to eavesdrop on telephone conversations from the telco. And the other example is Citizen Lab, which we already mentioned and said that we love. They, together working with them, WhatsApp determined that Israeli cyber arms organization, NSO, who we mentioned in episode 1 of season 2, used its spyware, Pegasus, to target Rwandan dissidents. And the other case is, in exchange for local knowledge and an advantageous location, the NSA from the United States provided Ethiopia with technology and training that was integral to this kind of electronic surveillance. So you're definitely seeing that there's a rush to provide these types of technologies and softwares to African countries. And I'm just wondering, like, what are the procurement processes of these governments? Like, how do they decide how they source this technology? And what happens to all these troves of information that are collected? Like, I know a big issue that comes up is having African or Black faces in facial recognition systems and mining that data that I think came out from the case of Zimbabwe. But yeah, I think that still opens a lot of questions for me on how is that data moving across borders?
Yeah, no, that's a really interesting point. And definitely, I agree with you. It's not just China. I mean, okay, China provides a lot, but other countries also do. So the digital Silk Road that, you know, normally people refer to is not just for the Chinese companies. I think Israeli companies are a major culprit here. Italian companies, American companies, you know, British companies. Yeah, so it's, and I think there's also politics about who we would like to feature in and who we'd like to talk about. And many of the, you know, before China came into the space, a lot of other countries, you know, filled this gap. So one other thing that we definitely need to talk about when we're talking about, you know, surveillance is also, you know, data privacy laws. The fact that majority of our countries don't have data privacy laws is an important one, but then the rest that have it, like your country, for instance, Uganda, like, have they appointed a data protection commissioner, Nima? Do we know what's happening to that legislation? Who's?
No.
No, it's very stressful because now they come up with this with, you know, data protection legislations, but then there's nobody to actually take this to. So right, so I think for me, it's not just about governments collecting this data. They will, legally or illegally, but like, how is that data processed? You know, where are the commissioners, the authorities that are supposed to be regulating this? You know, and we've done a bunch of episodes on data privacy on this in this context. So definitely look through our episode list to listen more.
And if we also, you know, talking about protection, I think the other bit that comes to me is like, who is thinking about protecting women, for example. Mm. So thinking about an intersectional approach, you know, we cannot not acknowledge that gender, race, and surveillance are so heavily intertwined. There's a growing number of apps that have been developed for men to be able to track their wives across the world. And yeah, women have been tracked and monitored for ages. That's definitely not something new. But these are the bigger questions in my mind, is like, how is surveillance going to affect women in particular? And when we're thinking about data privacy laws, are we thinking of it from a gender lens about how this impacts women in different ways? And what are the necessary protections that we need to provide for women in this changing context?
100%. And when you're talking about women, I'm also thinking about refugees, for instance, who are, the minute they leave their country, surveilled until they settle and, you know, acquire a different citizenship. And their context is also really peculiar, I think, when it comes to surveillance. So in addition to being intersectional, I think when we wrote this this episode was back in January, when we all were really naive and, you know, had so many plans for 2020.
Oh my God, what a different world.
You and I were supposed to meet how many times now? Oh, God. Anyway, so, you know, we also have to look at where we are today, right? Like, COVID has swept through the world, millions of cases, so many casualties. So surveillance is, you know, has become a common language in every household. So commonality of contact tracing apps, surveillance of citizens for COVID and non-COVID issues. Like in the UK, for instance, we've seen the, you know, the procurement issues with contact tracing apps, you know, a really dodgy companies being given, you know, access to, you know, health data. So a lot has changed. So the roles of telecom, you know, telecom companies, governments, you know, in many places have forced citizens to download apps. In Kenya, there's a proposal to contract trace on matatus. Can you imagine that? The matatu system by its own is so crazy. So imagining that you'd have to register everybody that hops on a matatus is just insane. In Norway, the data protection commissioner has tracked down the country's contact tracing app. So we understand the importance of epidemiological surveillance. Right now, the usefulness of this practice is not going to be contested in any way. But what happens with this all data, and what are the new norms that we have to grapple with when and if COVID, you know, is the fight against COVID, as they say, or the war against COVID is won. So one thing that really scares me is that what are the new norms that we have to think about, you know, and what are the new norms that kids have to grow up with now? Mm. Right? There's this whole idea of, you know, like, yeah, anyways, I'm going off tangent, but...
No, I think that's a good question, because that leads us to what does the future look like? And... Yeah, but okay, if I looking forward but also looking backwards. So if I think backwards to when I first graduated and I moved back to the continent after I was studying and working in the US for a few years, and that was when technology was the solution to all the problems, and that was the time when there were texts for a healthy baby or interactive voice response for a poor farmer who doesn't know market price. Haha, and you know, apps, more apps, build an app. But I sometimes think about, you know, back then, like what Twitter looked like. It was so optimistic. It was so, the future was so bright. And now when I go on there, it's so gloomy. It's just, it's doom and gloom. It's like, look at how they're misusing your data. Look at how these people are being surveilled. And yeah, like how did we go from that optimism of technology solving everything, and now we're in this spiraling downfall of surveillance and censorship and shutdowns, and we're waking up from this groggy dream of techno-solutionism, and, you know, some people are more awakened than others, and should we be worried? Should we be as pessimistic as we are? Are we just being needlessly pessimistic? How worried should we be? What can we, what is your take? Tell me. Predict the future.
Okay. Do you want to look at my palm? Predict the future. I think, okay, so there's one thing that I think we can predict about the future is if we start, because, you know, this techno-solutionism and where we are like 10 years ago was that we thought, you know, an app can solve all of the problems. Text for a healthy baby is such an insane idea. But I think we should definitely do another episode on this, is like the do no harm principles and the harm reduction. So if we had started from there, then we'd have been, you know, in a better place. But one thing that I would say is that, you know, all is not doom and gloom. And I can look at it from my experience as an Ethiopian researcher, activist that has been in the space for a while. There are many movements that are organizing from in different contexts to fight against, you know, growing surveillance. So, for instance, women that advocate for abortion rights, they're they've realized that the digital space is the current battle. So they're organizing to learn digital rights and to learn about digital security. Indigenous groups are organizing to put a stop to, you know, over surveillance of their communities. If you go from the US to Canada to, you know, very indigenous communities, like the Somali communities, for instance, in Ethiopia, are doing that because they know that the digital aspect of their life is equally being surveyed as their physical one. So digital security trainings have grown across the continent. I am in so many WhatsApp groups for digital security training for women, for journalists, for activists, for researchers, for professors. So 10 years ago, we were not having these conversations, right? So the growing tech clash against private companies and their, you know, need to monitor is being questioned, right? Like, so when the tech bros, you know, pack their bags from San Francisco and land in Nairobi, it's not the same, you know, it's not the same welcome with open arms, take all our data, right? Like, so there's that critical conversation now. And, you know, we're not in the best place, but it's also not that bad. I feel like, you know, you and I are here having this conversation. How many women do we know that talk about this as an issue in our work? A lot, way more amazing than you and I. So I think, you know, we have a good step. We're waking up to increase data grabbing, but we're also equally, I think, questioning that. I don't know if that answers your question.
Okay, I feel a bit calmer.
Okay, good.
All right, folks, that's it for this episode on surveillance. If you guys are interested, if you think this is a topic, because we could go on and on and on about different types of surveillance. So if you think that's interesting enough, we'd be happy to dedicate an entire mini season on this topic. Just let us know. We would love to hear from you about what other topics you'd like to hear about as well that we haven't covered. And yeah, listen to our first season. It was very short, but I think there's some good gems and we have come a long way in terms of our quality, and we're going to keep rising. So show us some love, share the word, tell your friends about this podcast. If you like it, please leave us a review because it really helps other people to find us and it makes us feel good.
Preferably a nice review. Something that says good.
Yeah, it makes us feel really good on the inside, guys.
Yes.
So yeah, I'm at Neema Iyer on Twitter. That's NEEMAIYER.
I am at BTAYEG at Twitter.
All right, guys, that's it. See you in a few weeks. Enjoy your summer. Bye.
Bye.